I think there's a certain parallels that take place in Parshat Vayeshev, which, again, I think are just so obvious that it's a little difficult to miss, but perhaps some people could succeed in missing them. There's essentially three parts, which really you can divide, if you wish, into the three prukim. In this particular instance, we can nod our heads to the Archbishop of Canterbury and say he did a good job in the way that he divided it. So we have Perek Lamed Zayin, Perek Lamed Chet, Perek Lamed Tet, really nicely divided into three different sections. So the first section is a section of what we can call the intrigue, the hatred, the jealousy, and then finally the sale of Yosef. And then the second section, Lamed Chet, is the Yehuda section, and the third section, Lamed Tet, continues on the Yosef story. Now, this parsha is actually one of the examples in our early Bible criticism, so I'm sorry that I'm going 100 years ago or so, but in early Bible criticism, this was one of the places that people pointed their finger and said, oh, take a look at this. There's a lack of continuity within the story, and the whole Yehuda story is just completely out of chronological order, which really comes down to one very, very simple point. If you look at the very last pasuk of Perek Lamed Zayin, the very, very last pasuk of Perek Lamed Zayin describes how Yosef was at the end of the day sold to Egypt. Look at source 16. V'hamidanim machru oto el Mitzrayim lepotifar sris paro sarat hapachim. And Yosef was sold, it could be he was sold many times, but he ends up going down to Egypt. That's the end of Lamed Zayin. The first pasuk of Perek Lamed Tet, which is our first source, is V'yosef hurad Mitzrayimah v'ikneo potifar sris paro sarat hapachim ish Mitzrim yad mishmaelim and Asher Haridu Shama. So we have, and then there are nuances here, there are differences which we could spend time trying to understand, but the essential message here is that it's the same verse, it's the same message, it's the same idea. Yosef was sold to Egypt. So if the very end of Lamed Zayin, Yosef was sold to Egypt, and the very beginning of Lamed Tet, Yosef is sold to Egypt, so then what in the world happened in the middle? So what happened in the middle is that Yehuda got married, and Yehuda had a kid, and Yehuda had another kid, and Yehuda had another kid, and Yehuda's kids grew up, and Yehuda's kids got married, and I can keep on going and say, hold it a second, and all of this is when Yosef is frozen in time, and then we a lot of time went on. So therefore, the argument, certainly if you like what would be quote-unquote called the documentary hypothesis, would be that, these are the Yosef stories, and then they found this Yehuda document, so therefore they had no place to put it, so they threw the Yehuda document in, basically in an indiscriminate manner, and threw it in over here, and therefore we have this story about Yehuda, which has nothing to do with anything. So that was pretty much the claim. You know, how strong the claim is, how weak the claim is the whole theory does not intrigue me all that much. But what is interesting, and a scholar named Robert Alter, who wrote a book called The Art of Biblical Narrative. But before he wrote that book in 1975, he had an article in Commentary Magazine. And in Commentary Magazine, he wrote, among other things, but he wrote about this particular problem of Yehuda, and he lamented the fact that people, even at this late time, 1975, that very few people have looked at the Bible as literature. By the way, I don't know if that's really true. I mean, define literature and define people. I mean, but I know what he was talking about. What he was talking about is biblical scholars who seem to be so obsessed with documentary theory that they were not looking at in terms of the literature. And his point was, and he came to this Einfalt, that on a literary level, chapter 38 is very much connected to chapter 37. So let's pause for a second, and then I'll come back to his argument, and then I'll come back to the way that he restated it a couple years later and why he restated it. Chapter 37 is about the sale of Yosef. The major issue which takes place there is, again, jealousy, hatred, almost murder, death, well, not really death, but death, warning, deception. The deception takes place, and this is as we tail off in the end, the deception takes place with a couple of different things. One is deception takes place with a coat. Two, deception takes place with emotion. It's false emotion. And finally, particular words, which the emotion are wrapped in on. And when the brothers send the coat to their father, and they finally say, do you recognize this coat? Is it your son's coat? By the way, you notice they don't say, is it our brother's coat? And I think that if... I think if Yaakov played that back again and again, hold it. Is it your son's coat? There's a certain aggressiveness in that. There's a distancing from Yosef in that. And I don't like that sentence. Do you recognize it? Is it your son's coat? Anyway. And Yaakov recognizes it, and Yaakov says, oh, Yosef was surely torn, you know, to pieces, and he mourns him. And then we get on to the next chapter, and the next chapter shows that Yehuda is very, very healthy. Because Yehuda is able to get on with his life, he's able to get married, form a relationship, have kids, and so on and so forth. And then something happens. Yehuda's son dies. And when Yehuda's son dies, if I were writing this story, I would write it much better than the way the Chumash has it. No offense. I would have Yehuda in emotional turmoil, and he would say, you know, look at this karma, payback. I now know what it's like to mourn a child, and my father is mourning a child who he thinks is dead. I have to go and approach my father and tell him, you know, look at this. You know, I am sorry for what I've put you through, but I know this is why I've lost my own son. And Yehuda doesn't do that. And that's what's really disappointing. But I'm just saying is that you can't miss that parallel taking place. And then the next thing which happens is he loses another son. So, and he's got a third son over there. And it's interesting because in his mind, he's blaming the woman. Like always blame, right? Blame the daughter-in-law, right? Because she's the one who makes the problem. I mean, Yehuda has no moral culpability over here. He doesn't recognize that he's done something wrong. And then as we move on in the story, she, of course, initiates this relationship. There's more deception which takes place. And the deception takes place. She asks for collateral, and among the collateral is his coat. And as she's being taken out to be killed, she sends him a message, and she says that the man who impregnated me is the owner of these things, and do you recognize this? And uses the exact same words that Yehuda had used back when, or the brothers had used collectively when they had deceived the father, right? Akerna, right? Do you recognize, right? And at that point it says, Vayaker Yehuda, you recognize. So when Alter originally wrote the article and commentary, he says, well, look at this. On a literary level, these two stories are actually very closely related. And therefore, as much as some people wanted to claim that these just come from different documents, he goes, different documents is not the issue. I mean, and it's really not the issue. The issue is on a thematic level, you have chapter 37, chapter 38 being so closely related, not just related. It's the same words, it's the deception, it is the code, and it's payback. I mean, that's what's more important. It's the continuation of the story. So, later on, when he published the book, he then noticed, that the rabbis in the Midrash had actually picked up on this 1,500 years ago. So I guess some people did actually read it as literature, but... so that was real interesting, because again, he came up with this, and he's a talented individual, so it's good, but eventually he came to the realization that the rabbis actually had beat him to it, and they had read this, and the rabbis... You know, the rabbis of old were very good readers of texts, and I don't know why they don't get enough credit for this, but they were very good readers. And now I want to pause for a second. See, what I would have said, or what I should have said, or what I could have said, or certainly what I have said, is that the reason why we have chapter 38 is something which our whole generation, raised on television and movies, and maybe a couple of us books still, understands completely well, and that is what we would call character development. We have the Yosef character, developed to a certain extent, and then pause. Then we want to develop the Yehuda character, and then pause. And then we're going to have the two of them collide at some point down the line, and that takes us all the way to Parshat Vayigash, and I really hope I have not ruined the story for anybody. But I should have done a spoiler alert, so just in case somebody here has never read it. So what you have over here is Yosef's story, Yehuda's story, then they're going to go on. But the truth is that just like the Yehuda story is playing off of the Yosef story, the second Yosef story is also playing off of the Yehuda story. Which means it's not just that I have one starting point and then two different directions that it goes in. And I'll say this again. And I'm going to start to say it in a simple way, and then we're going to continue, and we're going to look at the words of the Midrash and what it does, and we'll decide whether it's fair or not, because that's really what I wanted to get to today. That Yehuda does something, and not just something, Yehuda does a number of things which are quite disturbing morally. Yehuda, at this point, certainly the beginning of 38, sounds quite self-centered. He's somebody who fails completely in terms of empathy. Again, his father is mourning, he loses a son, no response. Tamar, who is bound to his family, you know, later on we find out there's a law called Yibum, but it sounds like they follow the same kind of laws there as well. She's bound to his family, and he won't release her. And, you know, so wait. So she's going to have to go through years of loneliness, again, as her biological clock is ticking, and she's, you know, just waiting to get on with her life. And then at some point, Yehuda loses his wife, and then he looks to find comfort. So, you know, this double standard over there between his loneliness or versus her loneliness, and again, his father, his wife, his daughter-in-law, and the whole thing becomes somewhat complex, and Yehuda doesn't seem to really care. But anyway, until Tamar teaches him a lesson, and Tamar is, without any question, the hero of this, but along the way to get to that lesson, Yehuda actually, and I know that many of you are going to be shocked because they skip this in most yeshivas, Yehuda actually cavorts with this woman who he finds on the side of the road, who he thinks to be a prostitute. There's actually a very delicate subtext to this, whether she's actually a zonah or a kadesha. So Yehuda thinks she's a zonah, and that's why he approaches her, which, by the way, is just a regular prostitute. And the fellow that he tells it to thinks she's a kadesha, which is actually a temple type of prostitute, which would have more idolatrous connotations to it, but at least maybe was connected to some kind of religious service, and he's there, he's looking for a kadesha, and Yehuda just hooked up with some kind of a zonah. But again, if we want to judge Yehuda morally, I mean, Yehuda sleeps with his daughter-in-law, but it's okay because he thinks she's a prostitute. And that's basically that's basically the defense over here. And on the other hand, when we get to the next chapter, by the way, it's good my parents aren't here today because I could say anything today. Right. And then we compare him, and this is what you have to do. You can't ignore this. When you compare Yehuda's Yerida, if you want to call it, Yehuda's descent, and that's what it is. It's a descent. Meaning, sometimes you make one mistake and then you pull yourself up, and sometimes you make one mistake and then you find yourself in a downward spiral. And you look over here at Yehuda, he seems to be in this absolutely total moral free fall. And I'm going to say it again, until Tamar calls him on it and stops him. And from that point on in the rest of the text, Yehuda becomes a different person. And he becomes a person of responsibility. He can't, by the way, do what we want him to do, to approach his father and to admit what he has done. He can't seem to do that. But what Yehuda can do is to take far more responsibility, as he later does with Binyamin. But when we stop a second, and then we compare Yehuda to Yosef, Yosef is also somebody where, and again, just to compare them briefly, and that's what I'm saying, how can you miss this? You have this sexual tension between Yosef and Eshet Potiphar, right? As I like to call her Mrs. Robinson or Mrs. Potiphar. And you have Yosef, and then you have Yehuda and Tamar. Now, Yehuda and Tamar is Yehuda hits on this woman on the side of the road. You want to say that she set up the snare for him simply by being there? Yeah. Right? That she entrapped him? Yeah, she entrapped him by staying on the side of the road, but that's not the same kind of entrapment. Right? You want to compare entrapments over there? Yes, she was standing on the side of the road. Okay? And Mrs. Potiphar? She was hitting on Yosef. It says it day after day after day after day. She's hitting on him. And Yosef refuses. Yehuda, first day, okay, how much? You know, that's what I'm saying, is that when you start in chapter 37, you have this partial Yosef development. And by the way, we're not sure. We're not sure when we look in chapter 37. There's so many things about Yosef that we're unsure about. And then we get to chapter 39. And suddenly Yosef comes into a completely different focus. But let's start and read a little bit, source number one. V'Yosef hurad Mitzrayma. Yosef was taken down to Egypt. Vayiknehu Potiphar, Sris Paro, Sarah Tabachim, Ish Mitzri, Miad Eshmelim, Asher Haridu Shama. So Yosef is taken down. Pasuk Bet. Vayihi Hashem et Yosef, Vayihi Ish Matzliach. That's an exceptional verse. How many people do you remember in all of Torah till this point, and God is with them, and they are successful in everything that they do? And that's what I'm saying. We did not know that in 37. Back in 37, what do we know about Yosef? We know that he is a Ben Zakunim. We don't know what Ben Zakunim means, but we know he's a Ben Zakunim. We like Onkelos, who says Ben Chakim. He was a wise child. Zakain as an elder. He was wise. Because if you just say the youngest son, it doesn't work because he has younger sons. And the other son's more or less the same age. Yosef, now we realize, is enormously talented. And Yaakov, by the way, did you notice back in Lamed Zayin, it doesn't say that Yaakov loved Yosef? It says, V'Yisrael ahav Yosef. I think that's significant. I think it's on a national level. He realizes that this is the man who should be leader. This is not necessarily a personal issue that Yaakov loves Yosef more than his other kids, right? And it's interesting because it just changed the name, right? Ela told that Yaakov Yosef ben Tzrias Rishona, and then it goes V'Yisrael ahav Yosef ki ben zekunim ho. Yisrael loved Yosef because he saw how wise and how talented he was. So when we continue now, and then Yosef has these dreams, which we can then say he has these delusions of grandeur. But what's the problem? They're not delusions. They come true. And if you're going to push me, you're not, because you're lazy today, but if you're going to push me and say, so why in the world does Yosef go and share these dreams with his brothers? Well, Yosef saw what happened the last generation when Rivka had a prophecy and didn't share it with anybody, and what kind of a dysfunctional family we had. So Yosef gets up and says, listen, this is what's going to be. And they hate him for it. They're jealous of him for it, you know. And as I said, when we're reading Perek Lamed Zayin, we're still unsure about how to read this. We know that Yaakov cherishes him. And again, we just keep thinking, okay, Yaakov really loved Rachel, and this is Rachel's son, and so. But that's not it. God is with him in everything he does. Don't we realize Yaakov sends all his sons to be shepherds, but he sends Yosef to shepherd the other sons. Yosef is the one who's going to look after the others. And then immediately, every place that he gets, the exact same dynamic takes place. He gets to Paro's house, he's put in charge. He gets to prison, he's put in charge. He gets to Paro, he's put in charge. Yosef, meaning everyone does exactly what Yaakov did, because everyone sees what Yaakov sees. They see that Yosef is enormously talented. And now, because we were unsure of it, and now we start reading, again, Pasuk Bet. V'yihi Hashem et Yosef. God is with Yosef. Yihi ish matzliach. V'yivet Adonav ha-mitzri. V'yar Adonav, not only... Now this is remarkable, because we have this pagan, you know, one of the midrashim that we may or may not get to today, it says that he was bought by Potiphar, Sris Paro. So they try to figure out what Sris means, if a Sris is a eunuch, not. So there's one midrash that says that the reason he bought Yosef is because Yosef was a good-looking young man, and he had designs on Yosef. That Egypt is not necessarily known for its morality, and he wanted to hit on Yosef, and then God castrated him. And therefore, Sris Paro is what happens afterwards, which, by the way, may explain why his wife was so forlorn. Now, again, a guy who is, and one more word about him. Vayiknehu Potiphar Sris Paro Sar HaTabachim. So I know I've said this many times. Afterwards, we're going to have the wine steward and the baker and the candlestick maker. And this guy is he's not the butcher. Sar HaTabachim is understood by uncles as the chief executioner. Sar HaTabachim, chief executioner. So you say, oh, that's a little scarier. By the way, why in the world would a butcher have a prison? Yes, because he's the chief executioner. That's why he has a prison, right? The butcher doesn't need a prison. Okay. Anyway, moving on with Yosef. Pasuk Gimel then is remarkable. Vayar Adonav ki Hashem ito. So it's not just that in Pasuk Bet God is with him. I don't know how to call him now. Our hero, Potiphar, who may or may not have homosexual designs on Yosef, who actually is a mass murderer, realizes Hashem Ito. He realizes that God is with him. That's just unbelievable. V'chol asher hu oseh, Hashem atzliach b'yado. And what else does he realize? That everything that Yosef does, God is causing to be successful. Do you realize what this means? That Yosef goes down to a pagan world, and he convinces the pagan world right away that there is a God, and God is with him, and God, and so on. And by the way, the same thing's going to happen again when he gets to Paro's house. Same exact thing takes place. He talks about God has revealed to Paro. 2 minutes later, Paro is saying, "Oh, is there a man that has so much spirit of God within him?" They all see it. So not only does everyone else see the capabilities of Yosef, they see one more aspect which we don't seem, you know, generally focus on. And what is that? That Yosef is a truly religious individual, not just a religious individual. It's much more than that. Meaning a religious individual is somebody who believes in God. Yosef is somebody who God believes in. That is just so much more. But not only does God believe in him, people can see that God is with him. Vayimtza Yosef chen be'inav v'yisharet oto, and therefore Yosef finds favor in his eyes. V'yifkadehu al beito v'chol asher natan b'yado, and he puts him in charge of everything. V'yimi az yifkid oto b'veito v'chol asher lo yesh lo, and once he put him in charge, v'yivarech Hashem et beit ha-mitzri b'glal Yosef. His house is blessed because of him. V'yibirgat Hashem b'chol asher yesh lo b'vaitu v'sadeh. Everything that Yosef touches turns to gold. Again, that's what it says over it. But I'm going to say it again. Not only is God with him, it's discernible that God's with him. So if we were not sure about the religious greatness of Yosef, when we're reading Perek Yud-Zayin, and I'm just going to go back now and say, I would like to say, you know, if you think this is like a huge leap, then I apologize. I would like to say that Yaakov Avinu had more spiritual understanding than Potiphar had. Yes? Is that a terrible leap? And therefore, if Potiphar is able to see the greatness of Yosef, you know what? I have a suspicion that Yaakov saw it as well. And that is what is the definition of Sinat Chinam. Sinat Chinam is when you cannot see the greatness of somebody because you hate them so much. And instead of saying that I hate them because I'm a loser, you say, I hate them because they're a loser. So the hatred that the brothers had to Yosef is what blinded them to his greatness, and they were willing to kill him because of it, and what will happen of his dreams, they can't come true. But you know what? They did come true, and they will bow down to him, and he really is great, and that's the tragedy of Yosef's life. Every person who meets him sees it immediately, except for one group of people, the ones that he probably wants to see it the most, and that's his brothers. And they can never see it. They can be in a room with him and not realize that it's him. Right? Who is this guy? Wow, it sure looks familiar. I mean, didn't we bump into this guy at some point in the past? And they just absolutely can't see it. But again, what I want to stress over here is that reading this description of Yosef shows us one, I'm going to say it again, of religious greatness. That everything he touches turns to gold. So Potiphar's no idiot. So what does Potiphar do? He lets him touch everything, right? You take everything because everything he touches turns to gold. And then we have this, and then we, calm down, Stu. And then, and then we have this comment, which is an interesting comment. It's the only time a male in all of Chumash is described in terms of his looks. You could say Esav in a more general way, Yaakov, but their looks are not described. Certain attributes are described about them, but not their looks. And then we're told, oh yeah, and by the way, Yosef was really hot. Oh, Yifei Tor, Yifei Mar'eh. Who else is described that way? Rachel, Rivka, and the cows. Okay. The cows in Paro's dream.
Oh, it's
the
same
word as you. They were hot cows. Okay. They were hot cows. So, Yosef is described as being also Yifei Tor, Yifei Mar'eh. And then we have to ask ourselves, you know, it's interesting because generally when characters are introduced or when we're told these kinds of things, and why are we being told this at this point? So maybe it's part of the story. And then we get to Pasuk Zayin, which I probably could have had as a new paragraph. And after all that, Vatisa eshet adonav v'tineha el Yosef v'tomar shichva imi. Right? I mean, this is almost as good as Yehuda's pickup line. Well, Yehuda's pickup line actually was, if you look in source 2, Tetzayin, v'yetela el aderech, he sees along the room, v'yomer havana avoy laech. Can I sleep with you? By the way, don't try this. Just leave it. And she right away says, you know, it's that's why I'm saying is that you have to look at these two sections and as being parallel to one another. And she comes off and he says, and I just want to pause a second. And if Yosef would have succumbed and Yosef would have given in to temptation and so on, we could have said, well, he's 17 years old and raging hormones and maybe very good career move. And maybe this would be a good idea. This, you know, could ingratiate himself with the woman in the house. Maybe this is, by the way, it also could have been a really bad idea. but sometimes when temptation is there, you don't necessarily think as clearly as one could in other situations. And I love the trup in Pasuk Chet, Vayima'ein. You love the squiggly shalshelet on the Vayima'ein, but maybe I'm being a little bit unfair. Vayima'ein. Yosef refuses. I didn't read it, Vayima'ein, which, okay, that we'll do on Shabbos. But Vayima'ein. Yosef refuses. Vayomar leishet Adonav, and he gives a two-pronged response. There we go. Back over here. Vayima'ein. Yosef refuses. But it's a two-pronged refusal. Vayomar el eishet Adonav, hin adoni lo yataiti ma babayit, is that I've been completely and 100% entrusted by my master. Which means this would be inexcusable behavior. After I've been entrusted this way, this would be a lack of decency. V'chol asher yesh lo natan b'yadi. Inin gadol b'bayit zeh mimeni, v'lo chasach mimeni ma'uma ki im otach, v'asher at ishto. He's entrusted me with everything in the house, but except for you. I'm going to come back to that response, I hope. And how can I possibly do something so wrong? V'chatati lelokim. And he just now threw a moral sense into it as well. And this would be a sin against God. V'chatati lelokim. It is actually echoes of Avram's discussions with Abimelech. Ein yirat elokim b'makom hazeh. That, you know, right, that was part of the reason. You know, that was part of the reason I said that it was my sister and my wife, because there's no Yirat Elohim, that someone can take somebody else's spouse. And Yosef says, no, this would be Chatati Lelokim. This would be a sin against God to behave like this. And Yosef, so as I said, it's a fascinating two-pronged response, and it's a well-thought response. Yosef is a moral individual. It would be wrong morally in terms of his master, with a small m, and it would be wrong in terms of his master with a big M. And Yosef communicates this. She, by the way, the Yikadarel Yosef yom yom, day after day. The Midrash says it went on for a year. The Lo Shemai Lo Shkavetz Lo Yotiman. He absolutely refuses. He does not budge. Well, I'm not sure how much choice he had. But Yikayomazeh, and one particular day, Vayivo Baita Lasot Melachto. Now, that is where the rabbis start to pick on Yosef. Well, what are you doing going to the house? Well, he's a servant. Ve'ein ish man she'abayit shem b'bayit, and no one was there, but titpaseu b'vigdo le'mor shechva imi, she grabs him, v'yazo b'vigdo b'yada, v'yanas v'yitzei achutza. So I'm going to say it again. The simple reading of the text, before you start to torture yourself, the simple reading of the text is that Yosef is a victim. And by the way, one of the better ways of testing this is make Yosef into a woman and put him in the exact same situation. And I want anybody here then to say, no, she was asking for it. And that's really what troubles me. Yosef is a victim. Despite, you know, right? Did you all accept what I just now said? He says no, and he says no, and he says no, and he says no. And she grabs him, and what does he do? He runs out of the house. And despite this, we're going to find within the Gemara and within the Midrash those who say, no, but Yosef is guilty. He shouldn't have walked in. He shouldn't have been there. He should have been someplace else. Should have gotten another job. You know, whatever you want to say. What are you talking about? Yosef says no, and he says no, and he says no, and he runs out. Why in the world are we find him guilty? And let's pause right now a little bit, you know, within this story, because actually when we move on to the next thing, just to end this up, and plus a cuff towards the end, Ve'yikach adnei Yosef otov, yitneu el beit hasar, b'makom asher yisiru ha-melech asurim. Where is he put into? With political prisoners. Why is he put in with political prisoners? Because his master's scared of him. Because he knows he's too powerful. It's not just that he doesn't want to kill, you know, the golden goose, as it were, but he puts him with political prisoners because this person can bring down the whole empire. Ve'yihi sham b'beit sar, ve'yihi Hashem et Yosef. And God is with him, which means the exact same thing again. God is with Yosef. So, and again, I want to just use this to address this point. Well, if Yosef really was this terrible sinner who was lusting after Eshet Potiphar and goes in to be with her and so on, and has a change of heart in the middle. And I said, there's all kinds of midrashim that all blame Yosef for this. V'yihi Hashem et Yosef. God is with Yosef. He was with Yosef before it started, with Yosef again. And especially when we compare Yosef with Yehuda. That's what's really interesting. Yehuda sort of gets off of all this. Why? Because he said he's sorry. Right? Vayakir Yehuda. Okay, so that's it. Men can behave poorly as long as you say you're sorry at some point. I have a book at home which is called The Art of Public Grovel. Grovel. Yeah, basically people who have found themselves in scandals and then sort of got out of it by... It was written by a professor from Princeton University. It's a book which is someplace between political science and history of religion, but it's very, very interesting how essentially you can turn all of America into a church and say, I'm sorry, and then be redeemed because you said you're sorry. And so Yehuda said he's sorry, so we forgive Yehuda, and then we'll make David from Yehuda, and Mashiach will come from Yehuda, and he said he's sorry, and all that is great. And Yosef never sins, and notice what we do to Yosef. Let's move to source number 3. I'm going to read a series of midrashim now, and we're going to go back and forth, and we're not going to read them all that carefully. Source number 3 is based upon source number 4, which is in Mishle. Source 4 first. Ve'rav b'ptaim avina b'vanim na'ar chasar lev. If you notice all those words which are bolded, mei yishalak rato, Shit zona unutzurat lev, homuniyahi, and so on. This whole section is using that part of Mishle and explaining it. And after these things. So the problem over here is, and as I said before, the first section ended, and then it said, Vayachad Rima'ela. The question is, which dvarim? Is Vayachad Rima'ela saying, after these things that we just now told? Or is it referring all the way back to the beginning of the Yosef story? So within the Midrash, we're going to have a back and forth over here on which things are we talking about. So over here, v'yachad v'me'ele, v'eira v'ptaim, elo ha'shvatim, amr b'levi, barav yitzavchim li'yinuka b'pitya, avina b'vanim, nar z'yosef, chasar lev, sh'ya omer lashon hara el echav, hayesh chasar lev yoter mizeh. So if you didn't understand every word over here, let me explain what it just now said. It's understanding, first of all, vayachar hadvarim ha'ela from the word dibur. And after all of that talking, and by the way, those of you who don't recognize it, that's not pshat. After all the talking, which talking? Oh, Yosef's talking. Which talking did Yosef do? Oh, he brought reports to his father. By the way, his father liked it. How do I know his father liked it? Because his father then sent him and said, okay, go and see how your brother's doing and bring back a report. So his father not only encourages it, he encourages it. And over here it says, is there somebody who's chasar lev? Is there somebody as heartless as a person who goes and speaks about their brother? Again, chasar lev is Yosef. Na'ar ze Yosef chasar lev. Yosef is a young person who's heartless. She omer lashon hara el echav, hayesh chasar lev yoter mizeh? Could you be more heartless than that? Umitman misham, from there, nitgalgala yiridatan lemitzrayim v'nei isha lekrato, zo ishto shel Potifar. So it's taking, again, this section of Mishle and reading it into the Yosef story, and what did we just now succeed in doing? Totally blaming the victim, and saying Yosef deserves what happens to him, because look what he did, he spoke Lashon Hara. And again, I'm going to stress, V'yachad Rima'ele, it says let's go all the way back to the beginning of the Yosef story. On the other hand, that one, by the way, is in Medrash Rabbah Pei Zayin Aleph. Source 5 is Medrash Rabbah Pei Zayin Bet. Davar Acher Ki Lo Yinuch Shevet HaRasha Zu Ishto Shepotifar Al Gorel HaTzadikim Ze Yosef. Essentially saying why it was impossible that they would ever hook up. Why? Because you cannot do kalayim like that. You cannot mix the species like that. You cannot possibly have a mixture of such a wicked person and such a righteous person. So you just now noticed, hopefully, that within these two midrashim, one is saying, well, Yosef is deserving of all, because look how heartless he is to go and talk about his family. And on the other hand, you have a midrash a second later saying, oh, Eshet Potiphar, she's this terrible human being, but Yosef is a tzaddik. So, and by the way, I'm going to keep on doing this, because the Midrash keeps on doing this, keeps on going back and forth from one part to the next. What was immediately before Vayyachem Re'ela? What was immediately before that? Yosef, and Yosef was good-looking. Right. Now, look at source number 6. Vatisa Eshet Adonav, she goes and she notices him. Lachein Anshei Levav Shim'uli. Quoting from Eo. By the way, it's never good when you quote from Eo. Mahi amunoto shel HaKadosh Baruch Hu, ki pol adam yishalim lo. A person is paid back according to the way that they behave. Oh, so mida kenegin mida, 100%. Rav Meir of Yehud Rav Shimon, vatisa eshet adonav etinei maktiv lamalu. What does it say before this? Which, by the way, again is v'yachad r'me'ele. Manyan bi Yosef yofei tarav yofei mareh. Yosef was really good looking, pleasant to look at. Legibor, this is like similar. Legibor she omed bashuk, umimashmesh beinav, umetaken besaro, umetle baakivo, amar li nae liyai nae gibor. That Yosef he makes himself look nice, he makes himself look pretty, and he walks around in a certain type of way, and he look how attractive I am, look how nice I am. Amrule, iad gibor, iad yoy, haduba kamach kum kapchina. He goes, oh, you think you're so good? I'm going to send this bear after you in order to essentially to annihilate you. Which means, yeah, blame the victim. Yosef is good looking. Now it's saying not that Yosef was really good looking. Again, look what the Midrash just now did. Rather, Yosef made himself look attractive. Again, Yosef in this household is now in charge of everything, so he has access to the hair gel, and he has access to the makeup, and he has access to all the things, and Yosef makes himself look attractive, and Yosef prances about, that's really what the Midrash says, he prances about making himself look so attractive, and somebody noticed. Who noticed? Eshet Potiphar. So this Midrash says, you get, right, what's coming to you, you behave in a certain way, and by the way, what's interesting about this is it absolutely, totally ignored the brothers and the father and the whole thing. Yosef is over here. Yosef is successful. He lets his success go to his head, and he starts to dress up in a certain kind of way. By the way, what's interesting about all this, all the things that Yosef is accused for here, the Midrash also accused him earlier when it says, "V'hu na'ar et b'nei bilha b'nei zilpa." Rashi used the word na'ar there because Rashi is based upon the Midrash. It says the exact same things when he was young. He used to dress up and he used to do his hair and he used to make himself look nice and so on. And that's there it called him Asen Narut. And Rashi used it there to explain v'hu na'ar. He's acting in a adolescent, perhaps, way, or childish way. Over here, this Midrash is absolutely independent from that whole earlier episode. And it said, again, quoting that verse or those verses from Eov, Yosef had it coming to him based, and I'm going to say this one more time. And if this were a girl, and she dressed up, and she looked nice, and she looked attractive, and then someone tries to rape her, you say, oh, again, we're going to blame the victim? So over here, what the Midrash just now did is incredibly politically incorrect, which, by the way, may not bother anybody, but what it's doing, and that's what I'm, why does this bother me so much? Because the whole description of Yosef that we had in this section was of a spiritual giant, and the rabbis seem to be coming from this perspective that it's impossible that such a bad thing can happen to such a good person, so it must be that somehow it's deserved. That's really where this is coming from. On the other hand, again, what I'm trying to show you is how the Midrashim are talking about it, one second, and what they're trying to address. Look at source number 7 now, and again, please notice, we did Aleph, Pei Zayin Aleph, Bet, Gimel, now Dalet, so in case you can't tell, we're basically going order in Midrash Rabbah, although we're skipping some. V'yiachar d'rim ha'ele, hirhuri d'varim hayusham, mi hirher, Yosef hirher, amar kishayiti beit abba, haya abba roya ezamana yafa haital sham, v'yoranenli v'haya achay mechnasim bi ayin hara. That Yosef, after these things, which things is it going? Going all the way back to the childhood again. By the way, Charlotte, what we're really doing here is therapy. Keeps going back and forth. Let's go all the way back to childhood, and let's go back. And by the way, one more thing. Why does his father show him so much love? Because all the other brothers have a mother, and he doesn't. He needs twice as much love from his father. Just a simple thing. All the other brothers should have don't tell Binyamin. Binyamin never knew his mother. He never knew his mother. Binyamin was raised by someone else. Yosef knew his mother and lost his mother, and therefore he needed more love than anybody else. On the most human level, all the brothers should have recognized Yosef is an orphan, and Yosef needs more love, and therefore his father is going to give him exactly what he needs, and everyone else has equal time between their mother and their father. Yosef doesn't have a mother. So I'm saying, on just a simple level, everyone should have recognized that. Nonetheless, over here, Yosef starts to think. So what does it say? Going back, which things? Yosef said, I was in my father's house. My father used to give me, you know, extra. I'm going to say it again. Why would his father give him extra? Because he needs more. But how did his brothers treat it? They did not take this very nicely. Total jealousy. Achshav shani kan, modani lacha shani berevacha. Yosef says, no, thank God I'm here in Potiphar's house. I can breathe easily over here. I can have my space and nobody's picking on me. There's no ayin hara. There's nothing bad over here. Amar lo kodesh baruch hu. Who hitlis? He says, in source 7. He goes, are you a single guy? That there's no, you know, you have no responsibilities. You have no parents, brothers, anything. You just, like, you're all by yourself. Chayecha shani magarebacha et adov. He goes, by your life, I'm going to send that bear. But I don't know what she looked like, Eshet Potiphar. But we keep on comparing her to this bear that, you know, is going to get you in, or she was wearing fur. I don't know. Yeah, right. That she's going to grab you. Dover Acher. Now listen to this one. Omar Yosef says, Abba nitnase Yaakov. Had certain tests in his life. Zikeni Avmavinu Nitnase had tests in his life. Va'ani Eini Menase. Why doesn't God ever test me? I'm going to test you more than I tested them. By the way, that's unbelievable. That's unbelievable. Because that's saying that the test of Eshet Potiphar is more difficult than the Akedah. I'd love you to try to sell that one. But by the way, you could say that on an emotional level, that maybe day after day after day, being hit upon by this woman was more difficult to withstand than the Akedah. I'm just saying, it's an unbelievable statement.
It was more difficult for him than the Akedah was for him.
Perhaps, but I'm saying, it's fascinating because it keeps him trying to explain, how did we get to this situation? But in these two sections, again, the first part, again, blaming the victim over here, that Yosef is finally able to live without any jealousy, without any intrigue in his life. God says, oh, you're comfortable? I'm sending the bear after you. And then Yosef is saying, you know, when will I ever have this religious test? Oh, you want a religious test? And fine, let's go for it. So we'll do one more, source number 8, Bereshit Rabbah Pei Zayin Vav. Dover Acher V'lo Shema Eileha. And again, I'm reminding you, he does not listen to her day after day after day. Afilu b'shchiva below tashmish, even to lie next to her. Matrona sh'alad Rabbi Yosi. This woman, generally matronas are not Jewish, by the way. This woman asked Rabbi Yosi, Amrali efshar Yosef ben shvasrei shana haya omeid b'kol chuma'o? Could it really be that Yosef was 17 years old and had his raging hormones, and he really withstood? You expect me to believe this? So he took out the Chumash and says, listen, when the Torah wants to say something happened, even though we cover it up afterwards, right? It says, look what it says about Reuven and Bilhah. Look what it says about Yehuda and Tamar. So if something happened, it would say it. Amar la, ma'im elu shehim gedolim v'rushut avihim v'lo kisalei makatuv, the Torah did not cover it up. Zeshu katan v'rushut atzma lachet kama v'chama. Because Yosef, I mean, he could have done it, he was by himself, no one would have known. And it says that there is no cover up here. You should believe the Torah when it says Reuben did, right? You should believe the Torah when it says Yehuda did, and you should believe the Torah when it says that he did. So what I'm trying to show you is that some of the Midrashim, Yosef had tzaddik. Some of the Midrashim, right, Yosef is the victim. Some said he brought it upon himself. He brought it upon himself because of religious reasons. He brought it upon himself because he felt good. He brought it upon himself. So, and there are other Midrashim, which I didn't get to, but what I'm still troubled by is why they're doing this. And I gave you half an answer. Half the answer is that they want to see the world makes some sense. Yes, there is an approach like that. Look at source number 12, the Midrash Tanchuma. Yosef refuses. So what does it say? How does this Midrash start? Baruch HaGever Asher Yivtach B'Hashem. The Yosef is a gever. Why is he a gever? What's gevura? Ezu gibor hakoveshet yitzro. So baruch hagever ashev tach b'ashem. At motzei kevin shayi bebeit rabo, when Yosef was there, v'hi Hashem et Yosef v'ish matzliach. Meaning, this approach of the Tanchuma is exactly what I was trying to show from the beginning. It's taking the story of Potiphar and reading it back in the previous section. What does it say in the previous section? That God is with Yosef in everything that he does. V'yaro denov ki Hashem ito. How does God see? How does He see that God is with him? V'chi Potiphar rasha hayoreh shekadosh baruch limo. Right? How does this wicked Potiphar see this? Umahu ki Hashem ito ela shelo haya shmo shekadosh baruch hu zaz mipiv. Yosef was a baruch Hashemer. Every single thing he did, Yosef would speak about Hashem. Haya nichnas l'sham shovaya bilachesh va'omer. He would walk in to help Potiphar and say, why was God with him in everything he did? Because God was with him in everything he did. Ribon ha'olam, atahu batchuni, atahu patruni, titein, titni l'chein l'chesed l'rachamim ve'inechu v'nei kora'ei, uv'nei uv'nei potifar aduni. He would go and say tefillat haderech, basically, in every single action that he would do. God, please help me. Please be with me. Let people see me favorably. U'potifar amalecha, ma'atam alachesh. What are you murmuring about? What are you doing? Shemek shafim ata oseli. Is it some kind of, you know, spell that you're casting upon me? No, I'm praying. That's why he finally understood that God is with him. He sees him davening all the time. He sees him praying all the time. But despite all this, so he just gives them all the keys and says, okay, you're in charge. You'll do a better job than me anyway. Now the Midrash Tanchuma claims that it went to Yosef's head. Thank God that God allowed me to forget the past, forget my father's house. So saying that Yosef succeeded in forgetting the past, and that was the punishment. So we've succeeded, even though we had a great start in the Tanchuma, we succeeded in once again blaming Yosef. I want to point out a 19th century approach. The reason why I call this a 19th century approach is that I found it in three 19th century sources and no sources prior to this. And then all of you could decide in terms, well, first I'll say it and then we'll decide. First we'll start with source 20, the Emek Davar, the Netziv. And this is the least clear of them. After all of this, when he was successful, he didn't have to work hard. And therefore, he was good looking. Why was he good looking? Because he didn't have to work so hard anymore. And that's why all this happened to him. El Yosef, al miboye, should say al ela pirushaya kishuta barat enav samuch li Yosef kedela ororo liznut. That after Yosef now is good looking, but why is he good looking? Because of his new station, and that's why she hits on him now. But as I said, this was the least clear of them. Look at source, we'll go backwards then, source 19. The Malbim, V'yachadrim Eile, Tchila lo ala ali balus not im evid bazui. It never occurred to her to sleep with a servant. Bazui, despicable. Amar, achar shirata ma'alato b'beit Adonav, nasa ineh el Yosef. But once his station had changed, now he suddenly became attractive. Look in source now 18, the Ketav Kabbalah, Batisa Nev El Yosef, Midhiv Sikba Mamar, Vahi Achadrim Eile, Bain, Vahi Yosef Yefetoar, Ze Yorad de Lomi Sibat Yefifuto, Hitterer Biker of Ta'avat Elav. So pause and understand what he's doing. It says, the last thing it said is that Yosef is good looking. Then it said, Vahi Achadrim Eile, so it says, you wouldn't have needed the words, Vahi Achadrim Eile, if all it was talking about was the previous verse. Because it would have been the direct continuation. So therefore, it's saying it's not just because he's good looking. After she sees his success and God is with him, all of this then together with his looks, it was only then that she decided that she can be with him. Right. Do you realize what this is saying? And by the way, just as a good ending, the Ita, and it also is written, Kima Amaram, de l'shem shemayim nitchavna gam hi kitamar. She really had perhaps good intentions, which I don't want to even touch right now. Do you realize what these three sources are saying? They're saying that Yosef was attracted because he was successful. And that women find success to be an aphrodisiac. That's what's saying. It's almost as good as money. Now, why did nobody say this in the 18th, 17th, 16th, 15th, 14th, 13th, 12th, 11th, 10th, 9th, 8th, 7th, 16th centuries? So my suspicion is that through most of the Middle Ages, whatever station you were born in was the station you were staying in. There was no such thing as moving. It's only after we have a collapse of the caste system that we have people who are able to move from one place to the other, and therefore they're looking at it. Meaning, otherwise you're a slave. But they're looking at it, no. They see somebody who's upwardly mobile. They see somebody who's going to be successful. So as I said, I just found these interpretations fascinating, because all the other things that we saw, the sense we get from the Midrash is either she is a wicked woman who is overcome by her own desire, and then continued because he's so good looking. Or we found that Yosef deserved to be punished, and therefore she sent from heaven to be his punishment, and now just fill in whichever choice you want, because he used to say Lashon Hara, or because he used to dress up, or does dress up in a way, or because he forgot his past, because he forgot his parents, or his father and his brothers, and he's forgotten everything, because he's, right? And as I said, all of this doesn't necessarily ring true. But I just found these last interpretations just so interesting. Again, it's interesting because nobody said it earlier, but it's interesting as well, is what does she see? She realizes her husband always was a loser. And why is her husband successful now? Because of Yosef. She's willing to move over to Yosef because Yosef is the one who's successful. Which means her husband without Yosef is not that impressive. Yosef, without her husband, may be very impressive. And that's what she finds so attractive. As I said, that's just a very interesting interpretation on all this. So let's just read. So one thing for Esther. Esther wanted the Radak in source number 9. Okay, so this is for you. V'yachad rime'ele, achar zman she'yosef gadol v'nechmad b'bayit mitzri, v'yoshav levetach, right, after Yosef became successful and he was settled, everything was for the best. Which means God is in back of all this, of working this out. Ulatovat aviv v'achiv, and this was going to, meaning he's about to claim what Naomi said before, what Yosef really comes to understand. That everything that has happened to him is part of a divine plan. That he gets sent to Egypt, sent to Potiphar, in order to get to prison, in order to get to Paro, in order to become in charge, in order to bring them down. Meaning, that's exactly what the Radak That's exactly that. V'alkol ha'yasiba l'tova, tolo t'vat aviv v'echa, v'afo pishe kashem mitchila. You like the understatement? Even though it may have been a little difficult in the beginning, haya l'tova b'sof. V'chein chet ha'mashke v'chalom paro ha'kol ha'yasiba me. Everything part of the story is part of, you know, God orchestrating behind the scenes in order to get to a particular place. And by the way, the Radak, as I said, I like what he says. I think Yosef likes what he says. I think Yosef says what he says, but just the Radak says in the beginning, and Yosef ends up saying it at the end. What we saw today, I don't want to call it confusion or... There are different approaches in the Midrash. On the one hand, we find this approach, which we'll just say flat out, it's the Yosef HaTzadik approach. Yosef is Tzadik, and Yosef is a victim, and this is how he's victimized, and Yosef is a Tzadik, and there were a number of Midrashim that say that. On the other hand, we found Midrashim which call Yosef a chote, that Yosef is a sinner. And it's very hard to reconcile those two things, unless you want to say that's reality, which I think Charlotte was trying to say before, that we are essentially a combination of these things, that Yosef perhaps may have been dressing up a little nice, maybe he did appreciate his looks, but on the other hand, he did try to run away from her, but maybe he did something either consciously or subconsciously, which caused to be attracted. Lashon hara. But again, what troubles me is the onslaught of Yosef, which blames the victim. I find the whole section, both before and after, to just have a completely different texture to it. It's this, in terms of the pshat of Chumash, there's this total, total appreciation of Yosef HaTzadik, of Yosef as being somebody who's described in terms that we don't have anybody else described this way. And I'll say it again, not somebody who walks with God. That's very nice. Right? Et Elkim HaTalech Noach, Noach walks with God. That's very nice. But God walks with Yosef. That's so much more impressive. Yosef, and it's manifest. And everybody sees it. And he is this religious personality that is totally, totally involved with God. And that's why I'm somewhat troubled by these Midrashim. I know it's motivating the Midrashim. Because they want to say that it can't be that such bad things can happen unless the person was deserving of it, which again leads us back to the Radak's wonderful interpretation, which is Yosef's interpretation. And what is this? It's not a question of deserving or not deserving. Sometimes we are part of something which is so much bigger, and it's very difficult to stop and take a very small piece, you know, of a very, very large fabric and try to understand what's happening in that very small selection, and sometimes we need to look at the much larger piece. And Yosef, when he does this, he says, listen, if I was never sold as a slave, I never would have become the king, or almost the king in Egypt, and the brothers never would have bowed down to him, which to him is apparently very important, and it is the prophecy, and the prophecy do come true, and they never would have come true otherwise. So for Yosef, this much larger fabric takes place, is what's going on over here. But as I said, the Midrashim, they look for the mistakes, and they look for the sin. Look, part of Midrashim sometimes are interpretations of things that Yosef did. Sometimes Midrashim is social commentary to tell us how we need to behave and how we need to improve, and therefore it points out things. What I try to show along the way is that a lot of the Midrashim would be, in our world today, be politically incorrect. By the way, that's either good or not good, which is politically incorrect of me. But it would be considered to be politically incorrect. But it's not just that it's politically incorrect. It goes against the texture of the pshat. And that's why I said, when we look at the three parts of the parsha, you look at the first part, we're not sure then how to really interpret Yosef. Then we go to Yehuda, and we see the fall of Yehuda, Vayered Yehuda. Then we look at Yosef, and again, Vayered Yosef. Yosef goes down, but then we realize, no, in retrospect, wow, look how great Yosef really was, and look how great Yosef really is. And now we go back and realize Yaakov saw it, but just, you know, really tragically, no one else did see it.